really pretty honored that my next guest is going to talk to me. His name is Professor Anton Haber, a name that everybody of a certain generation knows in this country. He's a veteran journalist, co-founder of the Mail Guardian, and a media expert. He wrote an article that was published in The Citizen a little while ago. The title of the article was, "We Want Better Media, But We Refuse to Pay for It." You can't get much more topical than that. Professor Anton Haber, thanks for talking to me on Chai FM this afternoon.
Sorry, I just want to clarify two things. It's good to talk to you. First of all, I'm former Professor Anton Haber. I'm no longer in that position. I'm just plain Anton now. And secondly, I didn't write that article.
Oh, well, then I've been egregiously misinformed. I didn't know that professors could be ex-professors. I thought it was a title for life. You're teaching me two things here this afternoon.
It can be, but I was an adjunct professor, and that's not for life.
Okay. I've learned two things this afternoon. Whether you wrote or didn't write that article, you say to me you didn't. Nevertheless, it's really worth coming to grips with the content of it, because we live in a digital age where we all want everything for free. We're not prepared to pay for it. Clearly, there's a cost involved. Take me through the situation. Take me through the arguments for and against.
Yeah, look, what worried me about that article is it seemed to be blaming the consumer.
Yes, very much so.
And if you're selling a product. Sorry?
No, I agree with you. Very much so.
If you're selling any product, to blame the consumer for refusing to buy it seems to me not a fully honest response. But the truth of the matter is that, news production, journalism was always subsidized by advertising, and that has collapsed. And now everyone is trying to get everyone else to subscribe. Now, one should say that some have succeeded and are making money through subscriptions and memberships and people paying. Others are struggling. So one needs to ask why some are succeeding and some are failing. That, I think, is a critical question.
I think that absolutely is a critical question. I'm just trying to concretize this in my mind as you're speaking. Give me an example of a subscription-based service that is doing particularly well, that's managing, and give me an example of one that is struggling.
So there's lots of international ones. New York Times is making a lot of money. It's got 10 million subscribers around the world. And The Guardian in London doesn't always make money, but it's got a big income from subscriptions. Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Financial Times. So many of the big international publications are. In South Africa, there's really only one publication that's building up a significant number of paid subscribers, and that's News24.
Yeah.
Most of the others are really struggling with online subscriptions.
So the irony is, here we have this platform that's able to get everything out to everybody that was going to change the world, and yet the big corporates are finally again managing to manipulate it so that they succeed and the others won't.
Well, there's a lot of truth in what you say. And when the internet arrived 30 years ago, we all celebrated the way it gave free and open access to almost anyone to speak to the world. But it turns out that the major media companies came to dominate the news world much as they'd always done. But of course, there was the new generation of big tech companies that became the really dominant players in this market. But let me say this. Mm-hmm. The problem with selling subscriptions, the difficulty with selling subscriptions is that there's a lot available for free. And young people in particular feel, well, I get a lot for free. Why must I pay 100% for it? Mm. So what this tells you, I think, is to get people to pay, you have to add real value. And I think a lot of our outlets have erred badly and made strategic errors in that when they lost advertising, they lost revenue, they cut back their journalism staff.
That's interesting. Yeah.
They reduced their newsrooms drastically. Those that succeeded are those who, in fact, invested in the kind of journalism that brings value that people are prepared to pay for. And that is the consistent pattern around the world.
That's really interesting. And as you're speaking, so my mind is going to somebody like Barry Weiss, who started the Free Press not long ago. And I must say, at the time, I thought, wow, this is a very, very, very brave move. And I believe that Paramount has just paid close to $150 million for an organization that isn't much more than a year old.
No, that's right. She clearly built something very, very quickly and effectively by reading the political climate and climbing on the MAGA bandwagon very timeously. And of course, they're paying a premium because they want her in to run CBS News.
Yeah, no, I
So it's
suppose,
a move with major implications. It's another MAGA takeover of mainstream media in the US, which I think is quite worrying.
we're not going to get into a whole discussion about Barry Weiss right now, but it is interesting to see the extent to which she appears to be walking back a lot of that right now. I think the MAGA movement didn't quite turn out to be what she thought perhaps it was at the beginning. That's another discussion for another time. Let's stay with this issue about paying for journalism, because what, in your opinion, is the effect for investigative ju journalism? Do you think it'll survive if readers refuse to pay?
Oh, there's no question that journalism will survive and investigative journalism will survive. We're uncertain of how it will be paid for, but it's a fundamental part of our society. We need information and we need people who sort out, who filter, who edit, who select, who tell us what's important. This is what journalists and editors do. And in the flood of information we have around the world now, we need that function more than ever. So I've no doubt that if we get it right, journalism brings great value to society and to individuals and to businesses. And therefore, we will find a way to make it work and make it pay. And we're all experimenting with different ways. We've got experiments here in this country, and around the world, media people are experimenting with different ways to make to make journalism sustainable.
Give me a couple of examples of that, because we're saying the subscription model isn't necessarily the most effective one. Subsidies, advertising, I mean, everything's going to affect one way or another on editorial integrity. What, in your mind, currently is the desirable model?
Well, in the interim,
Yes.
the only viable model at the moment is philanthropy. Foundations and wealthy individuals supporting media, hopefully benignly, because they see its importance to society and to democracy and to the economy. And we're seeing a fair amount of that in this country. And thank goodness for that. It obviously has its implications, but thank goodness for that. There are models of subscription and membership. So some people are trying to offer, you sign up for a membership of Daily Maverick and you get certain privileges. Sometimes it's premium content, sometimes it's certain invitations, certain access, and people are trying a membership model. People are trying things like holding events to raise money with their journalists, for example. So there's a number of different things being tried. Look, in the end, it's going to be critical that people do pay for it.
Okay, no, that's
And as I
interesting.
say, I think that if you offer value to people, to give them the information they need for their lives, for their work, for the society they live in, then they will come to be prepared to pay. But you have to add the value and build up trust.
I think that's probably exactly it. You have to add the value and build up the trust. You know, I look at my own choices of subscriptions. I rely heavily on news to inform me as what's going on, and I look to various different sources. But there are four or five that I pay for because I find without them, I can't function. That's my strategic filter. What is going to enable me to do my job? Which one do I absolutely have to have, and which ones do I trust? So I think you're spot on. I think it's all about trust and adding something unique. It's interesting times we live in. When you were a younger journalist, could you ever have foreseen, or an editor for that matter, that a particular journalist would be able to just feed a couple of commands into a ChatGPT prompt and be fed an article?
And no, and of course, AI brings new challenges to journalism, I must say. So we're struggling at the moment. But I think there is of course, we never imagined it at all. And even when we came to learn about it and imagine what impact it will have, most of us got it wrong and read what was coming wrong. But AI presents an entirely new challenge because, you know, at the moment, if you search for, say, information on what Donald Trump said today, or the results of the cricket match taking place today with the Proteas, traditional Google will give you a series of links, often from mainstream media, and take you there. But of course, what AI does is it gives you the answer without taking you there. And so we're very worried about AI using the information generated by journalists, but not paying for it, and not bringing people to the sites for which they have to pay. So these are new developing headaches that are challenging journalism.
And then just again, talking from a personal perspective, for me, just because you've read the article on the internet does not for one second mean that it's true. You have to go and do your work and triangulate and verify and re-verify and re-verify again. I mean, an example this week was Christian Amanpour said something particularly silly about the condition that Gaza hostages were kept in. She apologized for it. That's fine. That appears to be valid and correct. But Facebook was full of the fact that CNN had fired her the next day. That just is not the case. It's just not the case.
Well, you're right. And that's exactly why one has to be prepared to pay for reliable sources. I mean, the fact of CNN is you can disagree and you dislike, but if they make a mistake like that, they have the ethics of correction.
That's an interesting thought. That's a very interesting thought. You know, somebody, a Jewish pro-Israel who's come through the last 2 years, who's read about hospitals that were ostensibly bombed by Israelis, which they weren't, reported on by the traditional press, I'm not so sure that they are as reliable as they perhaps once were. And that really leaves us with a big problem.
Well, look, the speed of news today makes verification difficult.
Yeah, fair enough.
Although some of the internet tools, in fact, also help make it easier. But I think you've got to learn to trust certain sources that when they make a mistake, they'll correct it. Yeah. You know, I think that's the fundamental rule. Everyone makes mistakes with the speed of news today, but are they prepared to correct it when they get it wrong? You know, and we know many who have deliberately and knowingly. I mean, look at Fox News. Fox News were found by a court to have deliberately and knowingly published untruths about the January the 6th uprising in the U.S.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And that was true. And, you know, Tucker Carlson knew it was what he was saying was untrue, but he continued to say it. Now, that's an unacceptable journalism ethic.
Absolutely. Agree.
But there are others that I think if you can show them they got it wrong, they have to be prepared to correct it.
Anton Haber, former Professor Anton Haber, thank you for chatting to me this afternoon. I enjoyed every moment.